Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox podcast. My name is Dan Favalli. I'm coming at you once again, this time without my super duper co-host, Andrew D. Bailey, who, as we're recording this, is wrapping up law school graduation. Good for him. Hopefully, he's enjoying it. We're going to hit the Sixers postmortem finally today because there were some interesting rumors that were coming out of their exit interviews. Just before and over the weekend. Also today, a big news on the sports gambling front. And so this worked out really well because we have Chris Krause, a writer for CNBC, and he specializes in sports business and betting. He's also a staff writer for Hoops Rumors, and he's contributed to NBA Math in the past as well. He is no stranger to these parts. We had him on earlier in the season, and the timing just worked out. He wanted to talk Sixers, and the sports gambling news dropped, which is a pretty big deal, as we'll get into. Before we really cannonball into everything, though, I just want to remind everyone, implore everyone, borderline beg everyone, maybe even grovel, to please continue rating, reviewing, and subscribing to us on iTunes. That is the best way you can help the podcast at this point. It makes Andy's life when he sees the rating numbers go up or when he notices that someone else left a comment so that he can screenshot it to me and send it in our text message thread. Please continue to make his life and get on iTunes. If you do not use iTunes, we are officially, unequivocally, everywhere and anywhere you listen to your podcast, Google Play, iHeartRadio, should be on Spotify. I'm not sure if that was pushed through yet. Blog Talk, Spreaker, we're everywhere and anywhere, including Apple Podcasts. So just you can find us however you like and make sure you do. Lastly, but not the least important of which, you can still get 15% off at the NBAMath.com shop. That is NBAMath.com/shop, promo code Benno, B-E-N-O. Should be easy enough for you to remember because Andy shouts him out pretty much all the time. But now that the housekeeping notes are done and over with, we get to move on to the big question. Chris, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Dan.
So before we get into the Sixers, we've obviously got a lot to talk about with them there. Today, I believe the exact terms were the Supreme Court voted 7-2 in favor of overturning the federal ban on sports gambling. So there are some states that have allowed it, but it's just like it's this huge domino effect now. I think there is like 4 or 5 states with laws already in place to really just capitalize off this ruling, and there are going to be 20 plus more that are just trying to get it done post haste. And I'm just wondering, though this seemed inevitable, are you kind of surprised at how it unfolded, or no, were you just kind of expecting this from the jump?
I was expecting it to come. I was expecting it later in the month. But you know, a couple weeks early is no problem for anyone. Obviously, so many people in the gambling world and the sports world are very excited about the news. It's a really big day for America, and kind of gets us on track with the rest of the world that has sports gambling already in place.
People have gone back and forth with it, and I personally think everyone seems a little too excited for it. I think leagues should be allowed to capitalize off of sports gambling. That I do agree with. And there's been talk about, I believe they're called integrity fees and how that will work. Maybe every league gets like $1 of every single bet that is placed on them. But the fact that it makes gambling more accessible to everyone, is that a huge victory? It just seems like it makes it easier for people to lose money. And it's, you know, it's at their discretion, but I don't know if this, people are almost looking at this as with all the analytics out there, people will still be able to get an edge. That's just not, you know, the house is always going to come out on top. And so there's mixed reviews for me in that way. And also if it becomes something that these leagues all of a sudden heavily promote and inundate us with.
Yeah, well, the thing about the sports betting is a lot of it's used to attract people to come to a certain place. The casinos actually don't make that much money off of the sports gambling in comparison to like their other games. I mean, they make a killing off of, you know, all the house games, table games, even even poker, as far as what they take as far as rake. It's much less with the sports gambling because a lot of the money actually just floats from one person to the next. Now, you do have, you know, professional gamblers and people who, you know, understand how to bet and don't just bet on instinct, and they bet on data, and they bet with increased knowledge. And yeah, you're gonna have sharks versus minnows, and the hope is that that people don't go just blindly bet and hope that they're going to come away with winners and come away with extra income. That they understand it's gambling, and but yeah, it is a concern to have the extra attention on gambling and have more people come through to casinos and potentially throw away their money.
It's, and again, it's on the responsibility of the person too. I know gambling can become an addiction, but at the same time, that the age limit's in place, like we're all adults, the self-restraint involved is just supposed to be incumbent upon adulthood. I think it's just, as I said before, is if it comes to a point where you can have an app that's like, and I'm not sure if Adam Silver talked about this, I don't want to be imagining it, but way back when he was talking about having an app that would allow people to place in-game bets, like from the arena, live, these like parlays or these prop bets, excuse me, that's the word I was looking for. And that to me is just where it becomes that kind of being promoted by the league. That's just where I wouldn't have a problem with, I guess, a sponsorship being sold to the jerseys. I just, when it comes to that level of promotion, that's really where the gray area exists and where things could become problematic, just to me.
Yeah, and you're going to see that basically in all states that it becomes legal, because, I mean, most of these states have sports franchises already. Now, once New Jersey is likely to be the first state to come about, and they're going to have the online platform, and then you're going to be able to go into MetLife, and you're going to be able to bet on the Giants game while you're actually watching the game. You're going to be able to do the same with, obviously, Jets games. And in other states, you're going to be able to go into the arena and place wagers on the team that's actually playing in front of you. And, that's actually through the casinos app. That's through the sports betting operators app. And the league is just probably going to, I imagine if they haven't already, they just are going to increase, just increase the Wi-Fi in the arena so that everybody can actually get connected and actually have great Wi-Fi, because that's really all the leagues have to do. They can kind of sit back and say, hey, you're here and now you have more, more things to do during a game, and it becomes a more exciting product.
Yeah, and it's just so tough. I think, I guess where I fall on it, I'm not either, I try not to hedge on too many things, but this is, I guess the main point of all this is it should end up being a huge profit driver for the league, because for all the leagues, I mean, and we're talking NBA specific, if they're getting a dollar off of every bet, I would think that adds up over the course of a season. That is going to be, like, I would say hundreds of millions of dollars with all the bets that are being placed. And if you're able to promote it, and you're going to endorse in arena betting and offer more of these prop bets, live game wagers, that could end up driving up the bottom line to it even more. And that's going to be so interesting to me to see how it impacts the revenue of these leagues, specifically the NBA, which has just done a great job of capitalizing on some just more progressive means of exposure when you look at the way they treat social media and how they want to how they've been trying to expand their brand globally with the games that they'll have out there. So I'm very interested to see what this means for the league, its revenue sharing program in the next couple of years. I think that's going to be a fascinating element of all this.
Yeah, I mean, the salary cap is tied to the revenue, so you definitely, I think you're going to see all of that go up. You're going to see players get paid more as a result of this. And I think there's going to be a lot of businesses around the game that grow. As far as, if you're a tavern or you're a racetrack right now, and you can now add sports betting to your to what you have in house, you're just going to have more people coming through. And as far as what the league is getting, they're asking for 1% of the bets. They're going to negotiate on a state by state basis. Some states are saying they're not giving any. Some states are agreeing to X percentage. And it's a pretty, even if it's a half a percent of every bet, that's a pretty large handle that they're going to take. And there's problems on both sides with that. And one of them is it's trying to get the illegal bettors over to the over to the legalized market. And if you add one, you take one more piece out of the pie and put one more margin on top of it, now you're going to struggle with offering the same odds and coming away with the same profit.
This might be outside your scope, but do you think it ultimately becomes a situation where Congress leaves states to make their own choices on this front, or do you think there'll be some kind of, if not a very stringent form of federal regulation implemented for the sports betting scene?
Yeah, sure. I wrote about this today on CNBC. So we talked to the American Gaming Association, and they're a strong belief that it'll remain a state by state, only because that's really that's really how it's been for so long, right? And it's going to be hard for the federal government to take back the power from the states. While it may be a great idea for them to have a uniform front, and they could potentially say, hey, New Jersey has a good had a good deal with the leagues. You know, they only gave X amount of percentage, and every other state follows suit, or has some variation of that. But as far as an actual federal...
When it comes to your education, there's no need to settle. Get the interactive and purposeful education that you and employers demand from Colorado State University Global Campus. You'll get personalized, career-driven learning created and taught by today's industry leaders. CSU Global was built to help students succeed with affordability, flexibility, and individualized support. It's time to expect better. Find your path to the career you want at csuglobal.edu, where online education isn't another thing we do. It's all we do.
Framework, I think it's very unlikely to happen.
People were talking about, too, I saw this on Twitter a little bit, that they think this ultimately hurts Vegas a little bit. And I think you kind of, for me, right, in my opinion, touched upon this before when you were just talking about how the sports wagering is kind of a smaller piece of the pie when you look at what casinos do in terms of table games and slots and all that stuff. I also now, looking at Vegas, having been a few times, I don't know who goes to Vegas just to bet on sports. And that stuff has been available through the apps anyway. So they can should be able to capitalize on this themselves as well to some extent. But even insofar as it might dilute the number of places and establishments that are offering sports betting, I just can't imagine this really hurting Vegas all that much, given just what it's become, where the whole town, the whole scene is just this spectacle, and there is more value, I think, to them, or at least they're pitching more of the experience than the actual services that they're offering.
Yeah, I spoke to Joe Asher, the CEO of William Hill. It's a betting operator that's in Vegas, but also internationally. And he said it's a win for Las Vegas as well, because, the sports betting scene is just something to get people to Vegas, because there's so much more to offer there. And, with it being more widespread and kind of more accepted now, you're going to have even more people going to Vegas, and it's going to be just an extra thing they do rather than the main reason that you go somewhere. There's few people that get on a plane just to go cash in a bet, and if it's a large enough ticket, then maybe it's worth it. But but sports betting is a big piece of a very large slate of things to do in Vegas. But it's not the only one.
And now they can probably more. And I don't know the regs, like rules and regs here, but it's easier for them to set up like. Can you place a bet, and if it's a future and you're in Vegas and you did it, now they can just easily set up direct deposit to you or something like that. Maybe that opens up that possibility. I don't know what the laws on wire transfers then there would be, but I would think it helps, or at the very least doesn't hurt Vegas in any way.
Yeah, I think that Vegas is fine. They have a sports team now. They're about to get a second sports team. I wonder if that has anything to do with them feeling okay.
Two more questions on this. Well, I guess one and then one. I'll start with the one that I just found very interesting that I just didn't realize. So the owner of the Rockets, Tillman Fertitta, he also owns the Golden Nugget Las Vegas Casino, and they had to stop taking bets on the Rockets. And it's not even that. It's because they had to stop taking bets on the Rockets, they have to now pay out bets for people who gambled on the Golden State Warriors as being the top team in the West. And then if for some reason the Rockets make the finals, they have to pay out bets for people who wagered on the Celtics or the Cavaliers, depending on who's in there, as the team to win the championship. I find that utterly crazy.
I mean, according to their book, the Rockets just don't exist. So it's like, you know, hey, it's like who made it the furthest? And right now, the Warriors have already won the West in this book's eyes. And the Celtics have been doing something similar with Caesars, people who own Caesars also own the Celtics. And from my knowledge before this, they just never took games. They never took Celtics games. And you still can't get it through the playoffs, but it's very interesting to see actual bets paid out on a team that potentially didn't actually win that bet. And I wonder if sports bettors knew this when they placed their Western Conference bets, that this could potentially be something that would come out as a conflict of interest. And because imagine you're getting the Warriors and you don't have to worry about the Rockets. Like, that seems like a much better bet, right?
Yeah.
And finally, for me, I'm interested. It seemed out of all the reactions that were released from the different leagues and sports that the NCAA had like the most lukewarm response to anything. And I'm wondering, because theoretically this is going to drive up their revenue as well, the call for college players, college athletes, has to get even more profound now that this is happening, will it not?
Yeah, I really wonder if this leads to the college athletes getting paid, and I mean like not like behind the scenes, like actually like getting paid through a structured program or through some sort of regulation, because you know the risk is there. The risk of match fixing is there, and you know you're going to have the consequences, but then again you're going to have kids that are we've all heard the stories of the athletes who basically they don't get paid anything. They're not allowed to work jobs. And, you know, this could be a quick fix for cash. And you just don't want to see that in the NCAA. I think this would be a stepping stone to college athletes getting paid.
The compensation structure when the NCAA inevitably gets there, and I think it is an inevitability at this point, I'm so interested to see what that's actually like, because I feel like it's so... We talked about this on the previous pod coming out of Sloan that you came on a few months back. There doesn't seem to just be like a universally effective way to do it, just because when it comes to the compensation structure, it can't be this egalitarian approach, because there are players who are driving far more revenue than others. And then how do you really separate that other than, I guess, giving them independent freedom over how they go about profiting off their name?
Yeah, it's a very tough task to try to figure out how it should be done. But I'm of the opinion that it should be done.
Exactly.
It's like, how do you do it? And that's really the next step. And I mean, personally, I would say any athlete that can, you know, go to Nike and say, and Nike will pay them to wear something, that should be allowed. Like, I mean, if Nike wants to pay you or I to wear whatever, you know, to wear shoes or to wear a headband all day at work, is either one of us going to not do it?
No.
Is there any issue with that? Like, there's no issue here. Why is it an issue with this, you know, on that stage? And sure, that could get, you know, a little hairy with, oh now Nike's paying, you know, John Smith to go to Kentucky, basically, or whatever. But I think you'd rather have that separated from, you know, the state of Kentucky is paying John Smith to come to Kentucky, like through their Treasury Department.
And better the actual players, athletes getting the money, as opposed to like these companies paying people that are in relation to them or who promise them to the schools. Like, it just, there's so much of that third party, fourth party, fifth party bullshit just going on that at this point, that should be the bare minimum too. What you just discussed is that, like, these players being able to capitalize off their own name in some way and doing it where they're not even getting payouts from the NCAA, but they're going out on their own and they're getting money from these shoe companies or maybe even these agents. That should be the bare minimum of what goes in place.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, who knows when that'll happen, but I mean, hopefully something happens, relatively soon.
All right. But that was a good discussion on sports gambling. I didn't think we were going to spend as much time on it, but I'm very fascinated just to see how it affects league revenues, particularly at the NBA level and also the NCAA, just to see if this speeds up the process of student-athlete compensation. Now we move on to the Sixers and their outlook. And before we get into what they need, what they might do, I'm just sort of wondering, how you were left feeling after they fell in five games to the Celtics. Are you any lower on their future? Were you of the mind that they were playing with found money by even getting that far into the playoffs? Where do you kind of fall on this exit?
Yeah, I like to try to keep a level head with it. Definitely, in the second round, you're playing with house money, especially with, you know, Ben Simmons, who is a rookie, despite all the, you know, he's a second-year player. And then Joel, who's, you know, he cracked 100 games just this season. Like when you're playing with those as your pillars, you got to just be happy that you're in the dance. And then to beat a Heat team that, you know, despite you know, how competitive the Heat are, it was just house money at that point.
Are you at all, I don't want to use the word lower, but is there any more of a sense of urgency for you to say, hey, that Ben Simmons, after watching what the Celtics were able to do to him and how they defended him, that he really needs to, I'm not saying shoot threes, but that there needs to be some type of a floater in his game now, or at least needs to get to the point where you look at Giannis Antetokounmpo, who is still not an efficient jump shooter, but he still pulls up and he'll shoot some threes. And that willingness to fire away is a value in itself, because it at least makes you, in theory, a threat to do something outside of the restricted area, outside the paint. Do you think that that's, now there's more urgency behind Ben Simmons doing that now, or is it you look at it, oh, the Celtics are kind of an anomaly with the way they're able to defend him there, and you're not too concerned on that front?
Oh, no, it's definitely a little concerning, because, you know, you're going to have other coaches look at what Brad Stevens did and try to emulate it. And, you know, and if you're Ben Simmons, like, this should be one of the top things you work on. And he probably will. I mean, like, he's only had a few off seasons. But as far as what I'm more concerned with from the Sixers, I think, like, Simmons would be, like, probably, like, third or fourth of my concerns. I'm concerned about Robert Covington. I just really wonder if he can be a piece going forward. And, you know, I didn't have any of that going into either series. And also Markelle Fultz, you know, you always like to see your first round pick play, especially when you're going against Tatum, who's like, you know, the guy they traded him for. You would like to see him compete, but you know, he's also a rookie, and you know, we have two rookies that did not play their first season, and they both turned out pretty well. So maybe Fultz are turning the corner.
The Covington slant is interesting, because when they put McConnell in the starting lineup for him, that theoretically should have hurt their spacing, because McConnell isn't the shooter himself, but Rocco just struggled so much in the playoffs. And is that a function of him just really not being used to or really able to dribble? Do you think that maybe this is because it was his first taste of the playoffs, and now that he has that under his belt, it'll improve? And it's also, it was Brett Brown's first taste as a head coach in the playoffs, and maybe he'll be able to do more to counter a team like Boston's defense, where you can get guys like Covington moving more off the ball or just get them open. Because even in that series, J.J. Redick struggled to get daylight. It's just that Covington struggles kind of predated just that Celtics series.
Yeah, Covington's struggles really, you know, showcase his limitations. And, you know, that four-year, like, $62 million deal does not look good right now. And, you know, Brett Brown talked at the end of the season, talked about, you know, landing a big fish. And you'd have to think that Covington's deal goes into any deal for a bigger fish, just because, like, they need the salaries to match, or they need to, you know, probably get rid of some salary if they're going to make a trade. And I can't tell you right now that Covington's a plus asset. I mean, he's nowhere near, like, untradeable, but yeah, as far as what they could do differently to get him moving again, I think the role off the bench wasn't bad for him. I mean, he plays well. If he does stay, I mean, he played well with Bellinelli. He seemed a little more comfortable off the bench, but still, his numbers and the eye test didn't really do much justice for him.
I think what helps with Covington, and why he's easily movable to me, because his salary just plummets leading into next season because of that renegotiate and extend in the way they structured it. And even if he's just this regular season asset, that's still an 82-game asset. And if I'm the Sixers in the quest to get cap space, if we're looking at just cap space, he's not someone that I'm trying to move. I'd be more focused on getting rid of Bayless's expiring contract, even if you have to include a sweetener. If we start talking about Kawhi Leonard trades, or if LeBron wants to opt in and trade, force an opt in and trade to the Sixers, that's where I'm more open to getting rid of Covington. But when you're looking at utilizing their cap space or their access to even more cap space, I wouldn't be the biggest fan of turning him into collateral damage.
Would you deal Covington as part of a package for let's say like one of Toronto's guys, like Kyle Lowry?
No.
You don't want Kyle Lowry on the Sixers?
Kyle Lowry would be fantastic on the Sixers, but there are a few things there. He's older. Undersized point guards traditionally don't age too well, with Chris Paul being like a holy crap exception. And Kyle Lowry's been good too. Robert Covington's contract is just, you're looking at the average salary over the next 4 years, and I don't even think it cracks $12 million. So that to me is, it has the potential to be a plus asset. At worst right now, looking ahead to next season, I think it's an even asset. And the other thing is, if you're going to get another, I know Kyle Lowry isn't the most ball dominant player, but if you're going to bring in another point guard or just another guy who's used to operating on the ball, it needs to be the superstar in his prime, the LeBron James, even though there'd be more adjustments there, the Paul George, the trade for Kawhi Leonard. I just wouldn't do that for a Kyle Lowry, because he, even more so than looking at LeBron entering his age 34 season, that you uproot your timeline for. I don't think you do that for a Kyle Lowry. I'd even be reticent to trade Robert Covington for Kawhi Leonard, and I say this only because how much Leonard will cost in free agency in 2019, but even more so because he just played in 9 games last year. And what if this quad injury is chronic? Like that could be a problem.
Yeah, I think you mentioned on a previous podcast about like whether, like, if you were the Spurs, you'd be really worried about giving them the Supermax or anything close to that. Because this is the summer for it, right? Like they're gonna sit down at the table with Kawhi, and I kind of see San Antonio working it out with him. Especially if they're willing to, you know, offer up, the Supermax or somewhere close to it, because, obviously it's more than you can get elsewhere. But Philadelphia would be I think I might take a chance on it over Covington, because you know what Covington is now. And, I mean, he's a nice piece, but, the ceiling with Kawhi is, it's just higher. But then you also have, you put him next to Joel, and you have a lot of injury risk on your team, so I definitely see the hesitation.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to hit the fuck it button and say we need to kind of just dive right in for the Sixers' future, because we've already, even tiptoeing around the offseason, dived into it. Brett Brown did say, which I thought was, it was funny because it was like very wink-wink, but for him to say, per the Philadelphia Inquirer's Keith Pompey, I think a high-level free agent is required. I feel like we have the ability to attract one. That's just like, LeBron's ears are burning. Paul George's ears are probably tingling a little too. I would think that Kawhi Leonard, even though he's the trade market guy, he might be experiencing a little chill. Sources also told Pompey that the Sixers have interest in stealing George from the Oklahoma City Thunder. They're interested in signing him, and he'd be their best fit to me, better than LeBron James. So I actually don't think they should target, because Markelle Fultz to me is a part of all this. It's different if you have to move him as part of a deal for Kawhi Leonard, but if you bring in a LeBron James, and you have Ben Simmons, and you have Joel Embiid, Markelle Fultz is sort of in this situation where he needs to walk before he can crawl. Like, before you decide to turn him into a complimentary option, he needs on-ball reps to get comfortable with himself. And you're not going to be able to do that by bringing in any type of superstar. And that's the risk you run with LeBron James. It's the risk you run, to me, if you bring in another point guard, whether it's someone who's not really that ball dominant like Kyle Lowry, or you went a completely opposite direction for someone who is more ball dominant. LeBron, you do it for, I guess, just because he's LeBron, but I would be reticent to do it on anything less. And that's why Paul George, to me, is even more intriguing than Kawhi Leonard, just because, yeah, obviously the health issues now, even though Paul George did have that knee procedure that was, I'm not even sure the Thunder were going to announce it. He just blew up their spot by posting it on Snapchat. But Leonard has that quad injury, and he's become really ball dominant in San Antonio, though there's a clear path to him going back into that ancillary device status. I think Paul George would be the ideal acquisition for them, if we're talking about just in a vacuum and what would be the perfect outcome to the Sixers' offseason.
I like George on the Sixers. I mean, he definitely would fit a lot of needs, and I think he would mesh in well with the young guys. I just don't know how feasible it is as far as if you're actually looking at realistic targets. Try to steal him. He's in one place, and then you have the whole Laker talk, and now we'll finally get to see whether the Lakers were tampering or had any actual. Well, I guess they were tampering, but whether there's any substance to that. And, you can trade for Kawhi. If you get LeBron to come, I mean, I think that's also a long shot. But I think you kind of take what you can get out of those three. And, I think Kawhi is the most likely. But I agree. I think George would be a great fit. What do you think about Brett Brown? Do you think he's going to be there in 2 years?
2 years? Oh, that's without knowing how they finish the season next year, I honestly couldn't say. But I do, what I like about that question is you're guaranteeing that he'll be back next season, which I think is the right call, because people saying that he needs to lose his job or they need to go in another direction, I feel like you're getting way, way ahead of themselves. Like, there were different rotation decisions he could have made in the playoffs, but this is like the first time he was given a real basketball team, and it's not like the Sixers were dealt ideal circumstances. They didn't have Markelle Fultz, and while he was available, I don't know that after playing in fewer than 15 games during the regular season that you want that rookie in your playoff rotation. And this was Brett Brown's first taste of the playoffs as a head coach too. He needs to be given time to develop as well.
Yeah, I kind of agree. This playoffs kind of reminded me for Brett Brown is like the Monday you get back from vacation, and you know you're there, and you're ready to go, but you're not exactly sharp, and because you haven't been at work for a while, and not that he hasn't been doing great work on the sidelines, but he hasn't been doing that in-game adjustments on a high level, and probably since before the season, probably since San Antonio days.
Right, and a lot of people centered on or zeroed in on the decision in, I can't remember, was it game two? Was it game three where he went with Ben Simmons over TJ McConnell, who was just going off to close the game? And
yeah.
My initial reaction was Ben Simmons is your future. TJ McConnell is not your future. And because you were operating with found money, it's more important for Ben Simmons to get that exposure, those reps, for the coach to display trust in him that he can rebound from a rough start than it is to win that game and to give yourself a chance at the Eastern Conference Finals. Are we really getting like that ahead of ourselves here? People thought it was a stretch when the Sixers' over-under was released. They thought it was a stretch for them to win a playoff series. Then Joel Embiid's talking about winning 50 games, and they thought that was hyperbole. They do it all, and now all of a sudden it's borderline disappointing because they didn't make the Eastern Conference Finals? No. Like, it's not. And I actually appreciated what he did there, and he showed a willingness to then adjust from there. You saw the TJ McConnell starting after that. There are things to be learned there, and the offense did not adjust enough. The Philadelphia 76ers. The Philadelphia 76ers, they were not playing smart basketball on the offensive side towards the end of that Celtic series. I'm not ready to crucify Brett Brown for it. A lot of it was Joel Embiid kind of toiling away in the post. Even when he wasn't turning the ball over, it just seemed like he was using valuable time off the shot clock and taking too long to pass out of double coverage or even single coverage. This team it's not necessarily young when you look at some of the players that were in the rotation, but the experience in this situation, particularly for the key guys, Roko, Ben Simmons, Dario Saric, who is amazing, by the way, and we'll have to talk about him, and Joel Embiid.
Oh, yeah.
It's not there yet. And now this is the team that has the loss in on its resume from the playoffs, and maybe it's just one of those squads that needed this loss, needed this experience, so they can come back and know what they need to do over the offseason and how to handle themselves next year. To me, you'd almost hate to see them become the next version of the Oklahoma City Thunder. What if they made the conference finals a year too early, or the NBA finals a year or two too early, like that Thunder team, and then they're just never able to get back because everything they do thereafter, whether it's derailed by injury or something else, is viewed as this underachievement?
Yeah, I mean, this season has to be viewed as success, and everything after the Heat series is really house money. And, you know, health is not guaranteed. It's not guaranteed that they're going to ever reach the finals, but you know, you have to, overall, you have to, if you sit back and you're not caught up in that, in the Celtics series, you really like what you see. And, you know, Brett Brown's a part of that. And, you know, I give him credit for even his guys will run and run the plays that he wants them to run. Like, you know, that's not a given. I mean, look at, like, I don't know the whole situation in Oklahoma City, but, you know, Russell kind of does what he wants. And, you know, that's, you know, these superstars in Philly or future superstars seem to, you know, get behind Brett and, you know, and they're really on board with everything there. So, you know, that's such a positive. You shouldn't mess that up this offseason, or, you know, or even at the end of next offseason. Let's say next year they get the same outcome. I still think you keep this guy for, as long as it's not an egregious in-game situation, then I think you keep this guy. He's leading the people. He's leading the people. He's leading the kids of Philadelphia.
Right, and he seems very receptive to the analytics lineup data, which that piece that I believe was Zach Lowe of ESPN.com wrote is just super complicated the way the Sixers do it. They try and structure their entire rotations around it. You're also balancing all of a sudden these immediate expectations with Joel Embiid cacawing about how he needs to play and shouldn't have been on the bench to start the playoffs because of his injury and how he didn't want to play with the mask, and he's trying to take the mask off in the middle of games, while you're also grooming these youngsters, but you have all these veterans like Ilyasova and Bellinelli and Redick. I don't think, despite the Sixers obliterating expectations, I don't think this was one of the easiest jobs in the NBA to have this year.
No, you're dealing with a lot of unknowns. I mean, like, how is Joel going to hold up in the playoffs? How is Simmons going to do? Is TJ McConnell a playoff caliber person? You know, these are all, and like, what do you do with Fultz? It's like, what would you have done with Fultz? Would you have played him over McConnell? I mean, the Philadelphia media and the market would just, they love TJ McConnell. They're just like, they would have your head if you sat him over Fultz. I mean, I don't think it's an easy job. Now, I mean, like, he does have to improve. This isn't like a, you know, this isn't, you have this job forever, right. You know, but, like, you know, he gets another season to show. He gets an off season to improve, and he gets another season to, you know, have more of these opportunities, more of these in-game settings.
Now, let's say a trade for Kawhi Leonard presents itself. Would you rather, if you only had to give up one, well, one, would you give up both Saric and Fultz for Kawhi Leonard? And if you had to choose, which one would you give up if you only had to relinquish one?
That's tough. It's like it's really like a known quantity versus like the higher upside. Because I think Fultz has the upside. Will he ever reach it? It's to be determined. But you know, I wonder if they're going to ask for both. But if I had to give up one, I think I give up Sark.
I think I'm there too, in large part because Leonard, there's not overlap necessarily in the skill sets, but they're both wings. They could both be combo forwards, and if you're still going to have Roko, yeah, maybe you'll still have TLC, depending on how that trade goes down. If you want to look at bringing back Redick, if you want to look at bringing back Bellinelli, there's just not as much of a need then for Saric there. But I think it's tough because Saric outperformed everyone's expectations because there was, everyone wondered, should he start? And I think the general consensus was no, because his fit wouldn't be right alongside Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid. And he was just absolutely fantastic this year. Their starting lineup destroyed people during the regular season. He was an efficient scorer from three. He scored nicely off the catch. He was comfortable with his pump and drives. And to have that guy be sort of comfortable in that skin when everyone thought he needed to be more of this ball dominant go-get-it player is huge. But I'm with you. I'd have to roll with the upside, especially because, like, if you have Fultz, like, then you have a point guard, because Ben Simmons is technically a point guard, but at least Fultz is a point guard, you hope, with a more established jumper, depending on how much you read into what happened for much of this season. And McConnell's going to be a free agent after next year. You don't know if you're going to be able to afford to keep him. I think I would bet on the upside as well. And the last thing you want to do is, you know, you're already taking crap because you traded basically the right to draft Jason Tatum, and he is now leading the Celtics in scoring as they have a 1-0 lead over the Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Finals. And there's a to-be-determined element of there, but the last thing you want to do is then cut short on Markelle Fultz and see him just flourish under Greg Popovich.
Yeah, and you know, you see all that stuff on Twitter about like, oh, well, the Sixers, what if they had Tatum? And then you see the Nets fans being like, we should have him and Brown, and like, you know, it makes you feel a little better. But yeah, Tatum would be an absolute. He'd be great for the Sixers, and you know, when you talk about Fultz, it's like you almost have to try to make that work in order to retroactively justify what you did there with that trade.
What's also interesting part of their offseason is it's not necessarily a pick and choose situation. Like theoretically, if they want to clear the cap space to sign Paul George or LeBron James, they can, and then you can go back and visit the Kawhi Leonard trade front, because it's not going to take your best assets to grease the wheels of a Jared Bayless salary dump. I would think because he only has a year left on his deal, it takes your own first round pick. Maybe I don't think Justin Anderson would get it done. Maybe Richaun Holmes. I would not give up the Lakers pick most likely just to get rid of Bayless. So they could theoretically, and maybe that's a part of this offseason. If you're LeBron or Paul George and you're looking at the Sixers and you see, hey, I can sign there, and then they're still going to have the powder to go out and try and trade for Kawhi Leonard, that becomes an incredibly interesting situation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, let's say they get Paul George. I mean, who else are you bringing in? Because like, are you assuming that you're just not gonna get two of these people? Like, you're not getting Kawhi, you're not getting George. It's just so like, who's that secondary player that you're gonna go trade your assets for?
I think just because of the way that Bayless is an expiring contract, I would assume maybe you have to do two. Richaun Holmes, I really like him, but he is kind of, I don't want to say pointless, but you have Joel Embiid on the roster. Maybe you can get Ersan Ilyasova back, and he played a bunch of center with Philly. We even saw Dario Saric kind of moonlight there at times. So I would think even if you have to give your own first-round pick and to Holmes, that you're able to get off Bayless's money. Maybe it's as simple as I give up TLC too at this point, just looking at what the Sixers' window is now. And then if you're able to do something like that, then yes, you have to trade Robert Covington if you still wanted to sign a free agent and go after Kawhi Leonard. But you just said you'd give up Rocco in a trade for Leonard. And if you pair him with Fultz, or if you pair him with Saric and picks, like that's, you've built yourself an offer. So it's feasible. I'm not saying it's likely, but that's something that the Sixers get to sell Bron or Paul George on if they don't think that they're necessarily in the running. Is a lot of people said the Lakers can do this. The Sixers can do it too, and they might even have an easier path to get there, just because I think overall, when you look at the prospects they can offer, now collectively there's going to be more faith in Saric and Robert Covington, not a prospect, but just in terms of his contract and him being a proven commodity, and then just Markelle Fultz because he maintains that number one pick cachet, then maybe there would be interest in, oh, Brandon Ingram and Kyle Kuzma and Lonzo Ball. And the other part is that the Sixers' best salary matching fodder, whether it's Bayless or Robert Covington, it's not freaking Luol Deng, and that makes it a little bit easier for them to do stuff too.
Yeah, yeah, it's not a complete negative, and you know, I really think the Sixers have the best situation for any free agent they want to try to bring in, you know, this offseason of the teams with salary cap. I mean, sure, if with salary space, if you know, if Golden State Warriors say, hey, we're willing to trade, you know, a bunch of players to bring in, you know, to bring one of these big fish. Sure, that's a better situation. But of all the realistic destinations that the free agents can go, I think the Sixers have the best shot.
I would love to see Klay Thompson in Philly. If the Warriors just, maybe it's, you know, he's a free agent next year. I think it's really hard for them to carve out cap space in 2019 when you look at what they might do this summer. But if the Warriors if they lose in the conference finals, they lose in the NBA finals and just decide, hey, we can't keep all four of these guys together and you're not going to get rid of Steph or KD, I'd probably get rid of Draymond, or maybe not, because after the way he's defended these playoffs, but Klay in Philadelphia would be spectacular. All that being said, though, if they can't get one of Paul George or LeBron, and let's say the Spurs don't trade Leonard, because I ultimately don't think they will either, I also don't think, as you said, I don't think they should offer him that Supermax extension, but a lot of people, and that's another thing, a lot of people are of the mind that they can't keep him if they're not going to give him that extension, and that just feels like saying, oh, a coach can't play, like, coach a team while he's in the last year of his deal. Like, yes, you can. I know that the agents want the money now and want that stuff locked down. But there's what's wrong with saying, hey, you played 9 games last year. We want to make sure you're healthy. We're going to give you a ton of money anyway. But if you're as good as you're supposed to be, you're going to requalify for the Supermax before next summer. That's a different topic, though. I found that interesting that people don't think the Spurs can keep him and then not sign him to that extension. But let's say the Sixers whiff on all these guys, all these fronts this summer. Do you think they should then dole out that money among 2 or 3 key impact guys? Are you looking for them to maintain their flexibility and see if they can do stuff in 2019? What is your best case reaction for them in that scenario?
See, that's where I really like the Kyle Lowry matchup, because you got someone who's really good, as a spot up three point shooter, and you know, the more of those kind of players you have around this team, especially with Ben and the way, the way he kind of lacks shooting right now, I think that'll be, that'll be very good for them. But then again, that's going to cost you as well. So it depends on what the price is for Lowry and his deal. Because if the price is like you're giving up Covington or you're giving up Bayless and assets, to try to get to the point where, you're able to make a legal deal, then, I think that makes sense. But, outside of the top targets, I'm not sure what they do, because they can't give minutes to that many more people if they're going to keep everyone already.
And whoever you get, you need to make sure is just going to be able to play off of guys. And that's where I think there are intriguing names for them, potentially like a Will Barton or Tyreek Evans, maybe even a Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, who was a big part of the Lakers' kind of defensive resurgence this year. But those are all guys. KCP's probably fine playing off the ball a bunch, even though he falls in love with transition pull-ups. At what cost does it come? Forget about the money. It's, are we taking too many touches away from Markelle Fultz? And it's as you said, when you look at the Sixers, they're almost better suited to consolidate rather than add. And so you know that even if they sign a LeBron James or Paul George, unless they had to give up a bunch of assets to clear the necessary cap space, that's probably not the last move they're going to make, because the rotation all of a sudden just looks so clogged.
Yeah, and another name I like, if they strike out on all these big stars and they have to go and they want to try to make a marginal upgrade, what if Washington is trying to reshuffle the deck and Otto Porter becomes available? I think Otto Porter would be a really nice piece. And he's not the flashiest name, and he doesn't really get anyone excited, outside of probably people who've watched him all year in DC. But I think that type of player would be a really good piece for the Sixers, and he kind of fits the timeline a little bit.
Yeah, that would be interesting. And I've written a lot about the Wizards and how they need to bust up the big three. Porter is overpaid, but he's the player that you're fine overpaying, because he's just that, you put him anywhere, he's just that plug and play universal fit on offense, and then he can essentially switch between positions 1 through 4 on the defensive end. I don't know what type of package the Wizards would be interested in for someone like him, though, because it's not a Kawhi Leonard or obviously an opt-in trade with LeBron James. Like, what do you realistically give up for Otto Porter? They'll take Bayless as a salary anchor, but are you giving up Fultz in a Porter trade? And if not, then you're really going to have to cobble together some money, because I don't know that he's this huge upgrade over Covington, particularly at his price point, which means that you're going to have to throw in Saric and just a few other players to make the salaries match, unless that you're going to take Porter back into certain cap space, which is possible with the Wizards being up against the tax and wanting relief. He'd be an interesting target, though, and a great fit. I do think that Beal is more so the odd man out in Washington, just because John Wall's contract, the final year when he's 32, is going to pay him $46.9 million. I don't think teams are going to want to touch that. And if they do, they're not going to give the Wizards adequate value back in return. And then Porter, again, while I'll admit having him as your highest paid player through next year isn't the best situation, I think he's too valuable to what they need just because of his plug-and-play fit on offense and what he's able to do on the defensive end, which naturally then leaves Bradley Beal as the guy they probably shop hardest.
Yeah, and to try to get Porter probably take a little bit of an overpay, and then you realize what you're overpaying for, and it would get difficult for the Sixers. But Bradley Beal's a nice, wouldn't be a bad, like, what if they can get Bradley Beal? I mean, that's a, if he's on the market and you put together a package of, you take the Lakers pick that's coming, and then, you put together a package around, let's say, Covington and salary, and you get Bradley Beal, like I think maybe that's the area that you can explore.
I just don't. That would be tough for me because what does that do to your defense? And then if you're going to get Bradley Beal, that's another guy he's played off of John Wall, but you insert Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz into that equation. Is it tough to strike a balance there? There are so many guys that could potentially fit on the Sixers, but it's so complicated because Markelle Fultz makes everything almost tough for me, unless you're giving him up in a trade, and Beal and Porter aren't the types of players you give up Fultz for. I wouldn't sacrifice that upside. And so he's kind of how they view him is kind of the key to all this.
Oh, I don't know. I might give up Fultz for Beal. I think that's kind of where, like, I think there's a lot of skepticism around Fultz, and, you know, if they know him best, and if they're like, okay, this isn't going to work, or this doesn't have a high probability of working, then, Bradley Beal's no slouch, especially for a team that's looking to, has expectations to make the finals. In itself is kind of funny to me. But
do you think Joel Embiid, per his own comments, is going to finish, I'll give him some leeway, even in the top five of MVP voting next year?
He could. I mean, he was really good this last year. He's got to play more. What do you play, 63 games or so, somewhere around there? He's got to play more than that. He's got to get up to like 70, 75. Because I don't think that he'll. I don't think people will even consider him if he doesn't. He was pretty good this year in the games he played.
Do you worry about his shooting at all? 30.8% on threes during the regular season this year. Wasn't too efficient off the catch. And he was better last year. And you think that with a team that boasted better spacing, and he didn't really, obviously a smaller sample size, but his volume was virtually unchanged. He averaged 4.5 three-point attempts per 36 minutes during his quote-unquote rookie season, and then 4 3-point attempts per 36 minutes this year. Does that showing concern you at all? Because him being a three-point threat is kind of a big deal to their offense, especially if you're going to... He was so dominant next to Ben Simmons. I think they were roughly a plus a zillion points per 100 possessions when those two shared the floor during the regular season. But if he's not hitting his threes or someone that you can just leave open without worrying about the consequences, that compromises aspects of your offense. Especially if you, as someone who's talking about maybe they should trade Robert Covington.
Yeah, if he can't get it up to 35% somewhere in there, or at least you have to start to worry, and he can take one of the biggest defenders away from the basket, which really gives Ben Simmons and all the other guards that can drive such an advantage. And if they're not worried about him shooting, then you really clog the whole offense. So yeah, I mean, it is a concern. Hopefully it's a product of him playing, so many games for the first time in his career. Maybe it's a fatigue issue more than he's leading on. But yeah, I mean, you definitely want to watch it, especially coming in with this, with the massive contract. You expect more.
Now, before we get to the process anecdote that you have that I'm very excited to hear about, I want to do a quick exercise of naming a few players that we talked about, and I want you to tell me whether you think they're going to be... Well, I guess here's the first question. Do you think the Sixers are going to make a major move over the offseason? Free agency, trade, whatever?
I think it depends on what you qualify a major move. I mean, could they get an all-star? Yeah, I think so. Will they get one of the superstars, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, LeBron, if I had to bet right now, I wouldn't bet on any of them. And, I guess in a couple of weeks I will be able to, I know one of the offshore sites had Kawhi Leonard go to the Sixers at 4.5-1 odds, which, isn't great, but that was the highest out of any non-Spurs team. So, sometimes they say when Vegas thinks it's going to happen, it happens. And, I think Kawhi is the most likely out of the three, but, like I said, I wouldn't put money on any of the three to come.
Do you think JJ Redick's back next year?
Yeah. I think he comes back. I mean, obviously not at the salary he signed this past season, but I wonder if that was already kind of like you know, wink, wink in the works. It's like, hey, well, basically, because you can't front load a contract like, you know, like over like a certain amount, right? Like, so they couldn't give him $20 million in 1 year and then $5 million next year. I wonder if it was already like pre-negotiated. We'll give you like a, it's really like a 2 year $25 million deal or a 2 year $30 million deal. And he's just going to sign, he's going to re-up for another 1 year at X amount. And it's going to look like very reasonable. I would, but yeah, you have to, I think you have to bring him back, right? Like, he's really good in that.
And I think there was like sort of a wink, wink thing in place. And if you don't, if you end up striking out in free agency, you can do another like sizable deal with him. There's also, because they have his non-bird rights, there's some interesting things they can do there, even if they technically try and do some stuff in free agency. I do think he'll be back. If you had to rank then in order of likelihood that these players won't be with the Sixers on opening night next season, Saric, Robert Covington, and Markelle Fultz, how would you order that?
I think Fultz is the most likely not to be there.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. I think that they say that he's got the most trade value right now. And if you're, as Brett Brown was talking about, you're going after, you're trying to get a big fish, then you have to dangle a lot of bait. And, you know, Markelle Fultz is that bait. And I think that that's most likely. I mean, what is Saric is nice, but, you don't want to give up that many people. And if you give up, you know, if you give up Saric, you're probably going to have to add something else in and another asset to get, you know, to get your big fish. And, you know, if you're talking about like Kawhi Leonard trade, like, you know, Fultz plus salary plus, you know, plus a pick, probably, I think it could get it done. And then I think a Covington is the least likely. I think that they would have trouble, you know, I think they'll have trouble getting rid of that contract if they have like expectations of getting something significant back. I don't see the value lining up with it's not like a Luol Deng situation. They're going to want an asset for Covington, like a legitimate asset, and I just don't think that market there is there. Now, if they want to give him away, sure, half the teams in the league would take him at the salary, but it's a deal that makes sense for both sides. I don't see that coming about.
Him is kind of the Boston Celtics eventual Marcus Smart, that guy you re-signed just to trade. Is not something I necessarily considered, but with the Leonard situation, they could view him that way. Look, all I'm saying is if the Sixers want to get rid of Markelle Fultz, Tim Hardaway Jr. can be had. So if the Sixers want a wing and they want to include Fultz and Covington for Tim Hardaway Jr. and even Frank Ntilikina, that's fine with me.
You know, we can start talking up Tim Hardaway Jr. all summer.
Shit for annihilating that contract, and I'm just now it's. I just don't understand. I don't know anyone who's still in support of it, but it's funny how it's that people were trying to justify it, and it was I was flabbergasted. The Knicks gave out 2016 money, not only in 2017, but after it became clear that the market had already went the other way and was trying to correct itself. So that was such an abysmal move.
Yeah, I mean, if you just look at him in a vacuum without the contract, you're like, okay, this is a starter. He probably should be, you know, like starter, sixth man, somewhere in there for a majority of teams. But yeah, the contract just kills you. They're, you know, they're 2 years behind in their financial games. And, that's been the Knicks problem for a little bit, right? Like the decision making and the contracts they handle out. And he's not even the worst contract on the team. I mean, look at, you know, at Joakim Noah. Yeah. So the Knicks fans and the Knicks, the Knicks brass, I think they have bigger fish to fry.
All right, so let's get to this process anecdote that you alluded to. You talked briefly about it when we were talking on the side before this. I'm interested to hear this run-in that you had about someone who didn't understand what the process was.
Oh yeah, I'm actually very proud of myself for going this long without mentioning Sam Hinkie.
Oh my god, it was almost an hour. Yeah.
I know. I don't know what's going on today. So earlier in the NBA postseason, I had some t-shirts made up in advance of game three of the Heat and the Sixers. Now, these t-shirts just had a picture of Sam Hinkie sitting next to Joel on the bench. This was before Joel played in the game. And, they had the whole, Sam died for our sins. You know, he was born on this day. He died on this day for our sins. And then on the back, I had the city of Philadelphia. I made this whole grid with the with excerpts from the manifesto on it. And so I have this all made up through a t-shirt company in like a small mom and pop t-shirt company in New York. And 36 emails back and forth, we finally got it right. It was a very interesting process. It was a process to get this t-shirt. So she's the woman on the other line. She's very, you know, she's an older lady, very sweet. When I go to pick up the t-shirt, she basically sits down with me and she starts talking to me about Jesus and about there's another way. And then I go to find out that she thought because I had like Sam Hinkie died for our sins that I was starting a cult or I was part of a cult. She had never heard of the process. And I had to explain the whole process thing there. So I started with, you know, oh, well, once upon a time, James Anderson was the Sixers' best player. And here's how we got there. And, you know, it was, she was like, oh, I see. I was so worried. I was like, oh, it's okay. Thank you for these t-shirts. And, you know, so I got to spread the word of the process a little bit, but it was kind of a funny afternoon there.
Imagine someone not knowing what the process was. I just feel like it's just something that is now when you're born, you know it just because it's become just such this huge topic. Like it's just ingrained into, it's committed to everyone's memory. It's just uploaded there, just this organic act of whatever. So it's incredible that you had to explain to someone what the process was, but that's actually hysterical.
Yeah, she wasn't the only person I met that weekend that didn't know what the process was because I had the manifesto on the back of the shirt and I went to one of the Sixers bars in New York and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, like we'll go there. I went with friends. I had t-shirts for them as well. And, you know, a lot of people were just like, well, who is that person? He's like, you know, like some people were like, didn't know who he was. And I was like, whoa. This would never happen in Philadelphia. Like this would just never happen. Like, you can't call yourself like, the staff members there knew who it was, the whole thing. But there was people in the Sixers bar that were, you know, maybe like fair weather Sixers fans. And I was like, oh, okay. Now I realize, like, you know, the Sixers bandwagons get a little full. And, you know, I I'm in there during like halftime to try and explain the process. And it was just an interesting day.
God, how much word vomit did you burn through doing that?
A lot. And, you know, I realized I put too much on the back of the shirt. I have like probably like five paragraphs of text. And I was like, it'd be great for like a meme. It would not be great for a t-shirt. So, if I ever do it again, we'll keep it short and simple. But yeah, it was, you know, I almost felt like I should have like that. Maybe it is a cult. I don't know. Maybe I should have just, let it alone. Be like, okay, that's nice. You don't know what it is, but you know, you don't need to know. But, I don't know. I kind of feel like it was, especially like, cause I lived in Philadelphia during the actual process. So, you know, it has a special place in my heart, and, you know, I guess we're spreading the word.
I think it's symbolic, though, because the process was kind of like a religion, so for it to kind of just to be related to Jesus Christ himself anyway, maybe that's just, is there some symbolism there?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, like, it's, you know, people either love it or hate it in Philadelphia, and now I think everyone's coming aboard with, you know, we understand why it happened, and, you know, we kind of give, you know, homage to the past of the, you know, the people before us, but yeah, it was very symbolic, the whole thing, and you know, and it continues. I mean, I was kind of hoping that the Sixers would like somehow make a finals because like I think Hinkie would get more recognition now than he will in like 2 years from now when like, you know, he's so many years removed from actually, you know, putting together a lot of the pieces, but you know, maybe next year.
Do you think he'll get another job as an executive in the NBA? From his interviews, I can't even tell if he wants one. I say from his interviews, plural, from like the one interview he does every half decade or whatever it is.
Yeah, when I was up at Sloan a couple months ago, I was fishing around for this answer. And, you know, if he wants an assistant GM position, it's there for him. I mean, there's probably like a good handful of organizations that would hire him and would love to, you know, have his knowledge as part of their team. But, you know, is he only going to hold out for a top spot? And what would that, you know, what does that look like? And, but he is also like, you know, he's doing like regular, like day stuff. Like he's doing like, you know, he's got his hand in tech and investments and, from all accounts and purposes, he sounds pretty happy doing what he's doing. And I'm not sure, like, if you were the architect of this process, I think I waited out a little bit, you know, get the recognition. You know, he's definitely getting the recognition now that it's turned around and it's turned out well, or at least turned the corner. to something potentially great. But I wonder what kind of team what it would take to, you know, to hire him and to, you know, go through it. Is he going to go through that rebuild again? I don't even think he would do that. You know, I think it depends on the situation. Now, if he's taking over the Kings, I mean, yeah, sure, you go through a rebuild. But if he took over, let's say he takes over, a team like the Pelicans, like, and you already have your superstar in place, I'd be interested to see what he does in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. If you gave him a team, yeah, if the young superstar was already there, it'd be really funny. Not funny, but if he was ever put in control of the team with, like, the worst salary cap situation ever, and just to see how he works his way back from there. Like, give him the Pistons. Give Hinkie the Pistons, and let's see what happens.
Well, maybe he should just become, like, a consultant for teams, like the LaProfit. Nope. On CNBC. He comes over and takes over, like, failing businesses and just fixes them and then, like, lets them have half the share, half the credit.
No, I want all or nothing. I want full-scale teardown in, like, one of the toughest situations around the league.
How would you fix the Pistons right now?
You can't. That's the problem. Because every single contract on their books might be immovable. And that's a complete exaggeration. But you look at... It might be interesting because maybe you could get value for Drummond and Griffin and Jackson, but probably not. So I don't know. That was just give him. I would love to see him work in the NBA again, because while I don't think you can say the Sixers' model worked without question, they're where the process was supposed to put them. Whether or not that results in a championship is irrelevant, but the goal, I think the skeleton of the goal has been achieved, because we know the end game is a championship, but they still should act as validation for him. I'm not saying the process was perfect. If you could install a more humanistic version of Hinkie throughout that process, where he wasn't aggravating agents as much and kind of distanced himself from the players and treated them, there was just all those stories about how he was just so decentralized himself from the situation, but at the same time, you probably can't go about that type of process how he did without really removing yourself from everything. So the Sixers to me are more so a validation of what he was doing than not, but I would still like to see him work in the NBA again, if only just to see that reaction that incites.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I'm a big I want him back in the league, and I think he deserves to be there. I want Philadelphia to bring him to ring the bell, which is never going to happen, because like the entire arena would just go, like, I don't know what would happen to everybody in Philadelphia if Sam Hinkie just came out and rang the bell. I think like you might break some sort of record for sound barriers, and it would be a great situation. I don't know if the ownership will ever do it. Or maybe they will. Maybe time will heal.
Time heals all. But he seemed pretty bitter on his way out in that letter. That was just
I mean, how do you feel about the letter? I mean, like, just like this, because like that's the way to leave someplace.
Do you actually know what one of my main feelings about the letter was? Is it made me feel so inadequate as a person, because he's pulling out all these like obscure quotes from like educators and philosophers, and I'm just like, I have not read any of this shit. And you're looking at how well read and well versed he is in basically everything. And I took away from him. I'm like, this is something else.
I know, same. I said to myself, I have to do more reading because I'm not ready to write my manifesto.
Yeah, his like that was just like academic, like an academic manifesto to the upteenth power. And maybe that was part of it, was him being like, yeah, I'm the fucking smartest guy in the room and I know it. And of course, I'm going to crap on you on my way out.
yeah, it's I'm interested to see if there is like, I mean, like it will never be public. Like if anybody else writes manifestos like this in like regular, like imagine you did this in a regular like day setting, and like, do you think people would even read it? Would it ever be? I don't know. Like I don't even think
people read my tweets or the work that I publish. Or the manifesto that I would post.
That's funny.
Listen, Chris, this was spectacular. Some great talk. The sports gambling conversation was super fun. It's always great to chat Sixers with you, too. I super enjoyed your anecdote. I hope you're able to enjoy the rest of the playoffs, even though the Sixers are not in them. Make sure, everyone who's listening, that you follow Chris on Twitter, @CW_Krause. That's @CW_CR_Krause. OUSE. He, again, is a writer for CNBC. He does a lot of stuff with sports business and betting, which super topical for today. He's also a staff writer at Hoops Rumors, and he has contributed time to time at NBA Math because we love him, and he'll be back on the pod. So just make sure that you follow him on Twitter, again, at CW_Krause. You can follow me on Twitter if you like to read crappy things on social media, at Dan Favale, F-A-V-A-L-E. You can follow Andy on Twitter, at Andrew D. Bailey, spelled exactly as it sounds. You can follow our website sponsor, NBA Math, at NBA_Math. Also, be sure to follow us at Hardwood Knox. Please remember, too, to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. It takes 10 to 15 seconds out of your day. Just search us on iTunes, Hardwood Knox. Go over to those ratings. Hit subscribe if you haven't already. Leave us a review. Start really just going through your friends and family's phones and subscribing for them. They won't regret it. It'll be the best thing you do for them this year. Trust me. Until next time, though, we leave you with a shout-out to Kyle Anderson and absolutely, positively, no one else.